Welcome to AMA Edgewise. I'm Dave Summers. AMA Edgewise is brought to you by the American Management Association. Our guest on today's Edgewise is Lisa Gansky. Lisa is the author of the new book, The Mesh, Why the Future of Business is Sharing. Now, within the space of 2 days, both Dan Pink and Seth Godin were raving about it. So we tracked Lisa down, and she's going to spend a few minutes here with us. Lisa, welcome to Edgewise.
Dave, thank you so much.
To begin with, why don't you give me a little bit of your background? Tell me how you got to where you are right now in your professional life.
I've been an internet entrepreneur from before pretty much there was an official internet. I had the good fortune of working with Tim O'Reilly and Dale Doherty, who are O'Reilly Media and Make Magazine, respectively, today. And we started GNN, which was the first commercial website. We did the first advertising and online transactions and then sold that to AOL. And I went to AOL and had the opportunity to be the head of what was technically referred to as internet stuff, which included testing a number of business models and investing in various companies that were starting at the time or acquiring companies. Then I left and started to do some angel investing and work with some friends who were taking companies public. And so I sat on some boards. In the middle of that, I got very interested in doing something about the environment and got involved in starting an organization called Dos Margaritas that does environmental projects in Latin America. And in 99, I started a company called OPhoto. It was just at the time that digital was starting. And we had the vision that digital changes everything because it allows us to share and create experiences in different ways. And so we raised a lot of venture capital and sold the company to Kodak. I stayed with Eastman Kodak Company and ran digital services for them for 4 years, which included mobile and some other things.
All right. Now, could you describe a little bit what perspectives you bring to this? Can you explain?
So I left Kodak, and I've been thinking that all these new tools and technologies we have allow us to connect to each other and to things in our lives in new and interesting ways. The first 10 years of the internet, there's been a lot of learning how to define, refine, and scale businesses and create new experiences in businesses through sharing digital products like photos, music, and film, and certainly written content.
Right.
That has led me to start thinking about what would it take for us to share physical things, which led me to The Mesh.
Now, in the book, you spend a great deal of time on companies, for instance, Netflix.
Yeah.
But do you have success stories of maybe traditional brands in the physical space that are making an effective transition to the mesh model or at least taking it seriously?
There are a number of big established brands that are trying, as they ought to define, refine, and scale. They're looking at ways to test mesh-like strategies. So, for example, we see Hertz, Daimler, and a variety of car companies trying the car sharing model.
Hmm.
At the moment, I think it's Hertz and Enterprise. I know that Daimler has launched a car sharing service, and BMW just released last week, not necessarily a mesh model, but they're looking for ways to expand in personal transportation with different models. They've announced the bicycle business.
No kidding.
But sticking to the whole mesh concept, we are starting to see, for example, jewelry stores or fashion brands playing with the rental idea. They're inviting people who are potential customers they would otherwise not reach.
That's interesting.
On the reverse value chain side, companies are learning to share and connecting in an expanded ecosystem by recovering their product at the end of its life cycle and keeping the customer relationship in many cases.
Mm-hmm.
There are lots of good examples for that. In the electronics business, Best Buy has started to do that, and certainly the Geek Squad, a service that's in market, helps them with that in terms of getting personal data in addition to data on aggregate. Then there's Coca-Cola, who's reclaiming plastic bottles and has developed a relationship with a furniture company called Emeco.
Mm-hmm.
Worldwide, they're selling a product called the 111 Navy Chair, made out of 111 recovered plastic bottles. We know that plastic is a huge issue, so they've also created a relationship with Rickshaw Bags, and they're branding these things in a fairly conspicuous and aggressive way, which to me says the reverse value chain has a huge amount of value from a shareholder profitability perspective as well as positive impact on the brand equity.
Right. Now, I'm just curious, do you have any other examples?
Sure. The Gap has a program where they're recovering jeans. They have a third-party relationship with a company that converts that into insulation. Nike has spent a huge amount of time and money investigating sustainable materials for their products, and they've also created an open-source version that invites other companies to share information about materials called the Green Exchange. So we're seeing a lot of ways for companies to play in the space, and we're at the absolute beginning of this.
Right. Now, can you talk to us a little bit about the links between these shared business models and social media?
Yes, of course. Let's take something that people probably have some sense of, like Netflix, where you have the films that you see, you make your queue, you select the movies that you want to see next, or you have a list of the movies that you've seen before. And then you can set up relationships with people who are your friends and family who want to recommend films to you or give you the thumbs up or thumbs down on things that they've seen. And similar to Amazon, for example, you have lists and reviews. Those lists and reviews have a real impact and shape your action.
Mm-hmm. That's definitely true.
Historically, advertising has had an influence on people by making big brands bigger and more resilient and more powerful, with companies spending advertising money, shaping a really clever phrase or program, and then pushing it out to the market.
Right.
Now what we're seeing is that people's willingness to consider purchasing a product or what their perspective is about the brand is very much less influenced, and in some cases negatively influenced, by the advertising. What it is influenced positively by is people's friends and friends of friends and other folks that they think see the world as they do.
Mm-hmm.
So the social impact of influence is extremely important, and companies take note of that. For example, Ford last year and then again this year launched the Fiesta in clever ways where they've incorporated Flickr and Twitter and Facebook. eBay and PayPal and Facebook just created a way to do group gifting for the holidays. And a lot of the important people in the tech business are saying the first big wave was about content, and now it's very much about people.
Yeah.
So how people find interesting things is going to be increasingly shaped by the people who recommend them.
Now, in your book, you give the story about the local movie theater.
Yes.
It's the story of an assistant manager who implodes, and through the use of various social media, justice is served. And it's an indicator of where people really need to get a handle on the new reality, why reputation is a minute-by-minute thing, and you really need to guard that reputation very carefully.
All very true. The big shift to social means something very, very important to companies that have brands and have especially very large employee bases and reach. In the old model, it was very much about control. It was limiting surface area, having a few qualified speakers trained to stay on message and be terrific with the press and occasionally with an irate customer.
Mm-hmm.
In this model, it's completely upside down in terms of the surface area of who can talk.
Right.
If you have an international company and a brand that means different things to different people, and somebody in Mumbai or Wisconsin or in Middlefield is upset about something, the responsiveness, the authenticity of the message, and the freshness of the message in terms of who speaks on behalf of the company, what they say, and how quickly, often can take something that is going to be an out-of-control issue and change everything.
Can you give us an example of that?
BP, I think, is a good example on a world stage. They had the opportunity to be transparent and authentic and communicate directly, apologize, and try to explain what happened and fix it.
Well, that's true.
That stuff happens to all of us. As business people, we can make mistakes, and we need to be in communication, whether it's partners or employees or customers.
Sure.
The requirement for companies to have an interesting and different way of messaging what's really going on and to give very many and very different kinds of people the ability to speak on behalf of the company is a challenge, but it's something we all have to step up to.
Lisa, do you think other nations have a jump on the United States when it comes to the mesh concept?
The mesh is about moving from a world in which We needed to own things in business because it was strategic to do so, in our personal lives because it was convenient or for status or for whatever other reasons. So there was one option, and that was to own things. Occasionally, you could rent something.
Right.
In the mesh, the opportunity is to have access rather than to own things. And there are many countries mm-hmm. where they haven't come so far along in the ownership model that there's the opportunity to move straight to access. So, for example, at the time the shift was made internationally from film to digital, there were whole countries like China and India that moved mostly straight to digital cameras and from landlines to cellular digital handsets. So the question I posed to myself in thinking about the book and still am looking at on the worldwide stage is, are there whole communities, demographics, and nations that will move from ownership and go to access?
Actually, you had a fairly recent tweet along similar lines having to do with cell phones and the ability to bring hospital type of care to rural environments.
Yes. Cell phones are pretty incredible technology that many people in NGOs are using, mm-hmm. whether it's for pure science or, in this case, for healthcare. Applications can be downloaded, and they're very useful for taking vital signs of people spread across Kenya or various parts of Africa. It started in Kenya, but it's scaling throughout Africa, where people with a mobile phone can get data back to real doctors from a very far distance.
Mm-hmm.
The patient may never see a doctor, and it's been incredibly helpful for them managing things that could be of pandemic proportion.
Right.
I was recently at PopTech, which is a conference in Maine. There was a guy who runs an organization that's providing clean water all over the world, and they have an application that also runs on Android and I think the iPhone. So the mobile phones are really interesting, and there's many things that we can do with the technology.
Exactly. Now, in the book, you emphasize the urban advantages of the mesh model, but have you come across success stories in the suburban or rural or even in corporate or B2B environments?
Yes, I have.
Okay.
But of course, urban density favors the mesh just because there's more people and less physical space, so it makes for sharing. And if we look around our cities, many of us will be able to point out taxis and subways and buildings and all sorts of things that were meant to be shared from the original design. In rural areas, one of the things I've realized from conversations with people subsequent to writing the book, for example, Northern Europeans, is that there's a long history in a lot of rural areas and a lot of cultures where people live in a very community sense and share tools and vehicles, and they physically get together and help each other to do barn raisings or harvests or crushes or those sorts of things.
Yeah.
B2B scenario where I've had a lot of people reach out to me since the book came out who are in large companies and want to know how they can make their business meshier. A big part of what they're pointing to and what we've discussed is culture. One of my favorite things that I think we could benefit from really rapidly is sharing failures. Those are the things that get shared in a very protected way, largely in this country because of the fear of lawsuits.
Right, right.
But I use an example like bike sharing. Vélib in Paris did a bold move of doing bike sharing in the city. There were a bunch of things that didn't work, and what they did was talk about what didn't work, and that helped a lot of other cities all over the world figure out how they were going to do version 2.0 and 3.0, because there's been this open mood in which sharing failures in design was possible. And I think that's a really important place to start.
I think you're absolutely right. And I think it was last year or so, the program This American Life featured a short story about a department in the United States military called the Department of Lessons Learned. It started off as an 800 number, but then it became this website. And it was for everything involving logistics management, post-traumatic stress disorder counseling, whatever. And they were just trying to put all this information in a place because they didn't want to have people go through the same problems.
It's brilliant. And more of that would be terrific. I have spent time with a variety of scientists, and I see that as an area where people would be open because there's a real curiosity and orientation towards innovation. But because of the way our system is set up and because of the way people get tenure and things, it's often more competitive than collaborative. So knowing where to set those dials from a cultural perspective, setting the tensions right, can create some very inspirational and clever early mistakes in trying to mesh in a way that allows you to learn early and get out there with version 4 and 5, in some cases ahead of your competitors.
We've been speaking to Lisa Gansky. Lisa is the author of the new book, The Mesh, Why the Future of Business is Sharing. Lisa, thanks so much for being with us today.
Dave, thank you.
Today's business climate adds a new layer of uncertainty and accountability, making performance management even tougher to navigate. AMA has developed a new seminar, Performance Management, Minimizing Stress, Maximizing Effectiveness, which gives new managers a time-tested roadmap for developing and reviewing performance that aligns with rapidly changing priorities and organizational goals. For more information on this seminar, visit our website, amanet.org, and type 2822 into the search box. Thanks for taking us along. I'm Dave Summers, and you've been listening to AMA's Edgewise.